Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian Seawood. With me this evening is the very fine and reestablished gentleman,
Chad Mix.
Welcome to the News Hour. Sorry. It's not the News Hour. It is the Movies on the Brain podcast. Chad, news has broken. The nanny has thrashed Disney. Everything is upside down as the media has finally turned its attention to Hollywood because famous actors are now on strike and not nameless, faceless writers that you've never heard of. The industry has been turned on its ear and the great desert of the summer has begun. Your thoughts, sir, on the first 48 hours of the SAG strike, joining the writers on the line for the first time since 1960.
So I think just in the first day, I think the story is the missteps of the people in charge, particularly the people that we thought were like the adults in the room. I'm looking at you, Bob Iger, because
update his home insurance policy.
I'll get to that threat because I didn't actually listen to that threat until like an hour ago. Like, I'll get to that. But like everybody, like he's pretty thoroughly crapped on his reputation, which before coming into this, you know, people were like, he is the gold example for what people point to as like what a CEO should be for these companies, because clearly he's built up like he's built Disney up. The creatives were happy with him. The financial people were happy with him, which is something that, you know, typically doesn't go hand in hand. But to come out on the first day of SAG joining the writer strike and basically say that both of those entities are being unreasonable and the companies cannot afford the things that they're asking for. And then that's like within that same time, like within an hour or two after saying that, the news comes out that, you know, he's extended for another 3 years and his salary is $25 million a year. Like, his PR is generally good. He normally has a good, like, instinctual feel for this kind of stuff. But like, man, like he just blew it all at once yesterday. I don't want to focus on him because the real thing is the fact that this is like monumental with that. It's just that I think he epitomizes how monumental this is, that a person this larger than like most of the other CEOs, this more respected than the other ones, can come out. And because it looks like he felt the pressure and he miscalculated in what he said, and he's paying the price for it pretty bad. But again, that's the magnitude of this. Because now everything's like, productions were going on while the writers were on strike, but nothing could be written. Nothing could be like changed in scripts. But as long as you had the actors and the directors, you know, whatever deal they took, you can get on. But now the town is shut down. Hollywood is shut down until something has happened. And I'm glad that it happened for the fact that I think they would have shook the writers down. They would have tried to shake the writers down. And it's all well and good until people start losing.
I mean, they said that. They literally said it. They told Deadline.
Some nameless exec said that they were going to starve the writers out. And when they start losing apartments and homes, they'll come to the table and basically take whatever we're going to give them. And that is what Ron Perlman's threat that Brian alluded to earlier was in regards to. And I don't, like, when I first saw it, I thought he was talking about Iger, but he's talking about whoever said that. And apparently whoever said that, this is like, it was said in an article with, it wasn't attributed to anybody. It was like this person from higher up and on this side of the negotiation said this. And us normal people don't know, but apparently the people that need to know who it is. And that's who he's talking to. He's like, we know who you are. Your name ain't in the paper, but we know, and we know where you live. And Ron Perlman looks like the kind of dude that, well, you know, at this age, he might not personally break kneecaps, but he knows people that will break kneecaps. So
the key there is that Perlman said, we know that this dude makes $25 million a year.
Okay, so I didn't hear that part.
Which was the exact figure of that Iger was just reported to have signed an extension for.
Wow.
Probably best not to mess with the dude who played Hellboy.
I mean, if it turns out that it was Iger that said that, one, he's really, like, really, really, really tripping. Because there's no reason for him to open his mouth about any of this, especially say something like that. The stuff he said in the press is bad enough, but to say this kind of stuff on the slick without his name on it, no. Like, there should be, you know, journalistic integrity, and the person that he told that to shouldn't allude to or say where they got it from to anyone ever. But if I'm Bob Iger, I can't trust that. I can't trust that you ain't going to tell your girlfriend who's not going to tell her girlfriend, who ain't going to tell somebody else, and then everybody across town knows. I ain't saying nothing close to this. So if it was him, he's had a colossal lapse in judgment in the past week, enough that makes me question a whole bunch of things going forward. But I'm going to take it. That is not him, but it's somebody else that makes an obscene amount of money. I don't know, Netflix guy, for example. Maybe something like that. But whoever said it.
Allegedly, they had a video conference afterward where they were all pointing the finger at each other and outraged at the reaction to it and blaming each other for it. And it's like, did you guys not coordinate and all decide that this was a good idea? Or did just one random dude go to Deadline and is like, yo, bros, here's our plan. See you at Halloween.
And that's why it makes me think that it's one of the newer players, like a Netflix, like an Apple, that haven't had to do this kind of stuff. But Zaslav's been in TV long enough. He should know. Even I know whatever it is, the Learning Channel, whatever. And they do a whole bunch of unscripted stuff, but he came from like network TV further down the line. He should be at least familiar with this. So I don't, even with his questionable decision making, I don't think he would even say it. It makes more sense to be Apple or Netflix.
I love how we're playing the game of who was stupid enough to say we are going to make them wait to the long cold winter of Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. Because I mean, whoever said it's so dumb. It's so dumb. This whole thing, I don't think the people in charge are really reading the room, because I mean, I know this country has turned on unions, but the places that still have unions and still have strong unions, those unions work for their members. And it's not just Hollywood, because I just saw UPS is thinking about going on strike. I see all these union things about basically workers are fed up. They realize that the way the money is working, it's the company's only there to make profit. And the best way for them to make profit is to strangle out their workers. And the workers are like, F you, pay me. And more of them are saying the same thing. And now these dudes in Hollywood have gone on and basically gave the biggest stage to workers' rights right there. Because it's effing Hollywood. And I saw somebody tweet, I can't remember, but they're like, so they're basically opening up a fight with the most charismatic people in the world. It was one thing to do it with the writers. They knew they could starve out the writers, which is why they should have never let it get to the actors. They should have tap danced more for the actors, because you can, as bad as it is, you can get the public perception of the writers to be one thing, because it's not hard to make people think they're being greedy. People like falling in line with the money people. I don't know why. It's dumb to me. But now that you got the actors, and now the actors, again, these people are trained to perform. So they're going to bring all that skill and charisma and say, no, them. And people are going to start to listen. And all these other worker rights, they really could have, this could be like the powder keg that kind of continues pushing that forward.
Well, and the other thing too is that, like, you know, Matt Damon had his statement, you know, kind of edited by Deadline, and his people got onto them so quickly to get it changed. We also got the huge reveal right after the SAG press conference late last night, that one of the things that is being negotiated and is on the table is AI likenesses. Mm-hmm. And that they have been, there have been some productions that have been scanning the likenesses of extras without their knowledge or consent and saving that image data to potentially use it again sometime down the line without that particular actor's permission or consent or compensating them in any kind of way for that residual performance. And that's very violating.
Yeah, I mean, when Donald Glover did, I don't remember if it was Spider-Man or Star Wars, but he, after that, he was like, you know, they scammed me and I'm in their databases now. So he was making light of it, and it wasn't like nobody viewed it like this. But Disney is apparently notorious for, if you work on their stuff, they're going to have scans of you. So with this new, with what they were talking about now with the AI, they can use those scans. They can use those people anytime they want. If you've worked on a Disney property, you've gotten scanned. So they can use your likeness whenever they want.
Well, the thing is, they were starting with background actors, which is a very scary thing because background actors make up a large percentage of SAG, and they get work more consistently than, say, your regular working actor, just because you can just be there and show up. And casting directors love extras because it's finding extras is easy because your cost is less and all those good things. But like this conversation, I feel, started with the Tarkin thing, with the notion that you could take Alan, take Peter Cushing's likeness and completely redo it for a completely new performance. Now, granted, you know, Carrie Fisher's estate signed off on the use of that likeness. Peter Cushing's estate signed off on that likeness.
Harold Ramis's.
Harold Ramis's daughter signed off on the use of that. Like, so far, the major ones, the estates have signed off on, but it also opens up that vast can of worms of how long is that permission granted for? Could they continue to use that name, image, and likeness in that way without consulting because they've already gotten the permission once?
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a whole slippery slope legal peril, and it comes down to wanting not to pay for labor.
Yeah.
It comes down to, I will pay you once, and I will pay you this amount of money. And after that, I don't want to pay you anymore, but I still want to use your performance. Like, it's crazy. It's insane, because it's like, basically what you're doing is you're saying, I want to pay you X small amount of money for a lifetime of work, potentially.
Yeah.
It's insane. But the idea is to drive down labor costs and to increase profitability.
That's the name of the game.
And to manipulate quality of performance, because they can dictate through what they feed into the computer how the portrayal happens, so you don't need directors. You don't need producers. Like, you just create the performance that you want and stick it in there. It's like, we were both around for the writer's strike of 08. We both remember how that whole thing went down, and that was over streaming. That was over the original wave of like streaming services and shows produced directly for streamers. And they got a deal fairly close to what they wanted back then. And it's a good thing that they did, because otherwise, when the rocket ship of streaming took off, the Writers Guild would have been screwed. But this is like, I'm happy for the actors, because not only do the actors deserve the right deal, the writers would have been sunk without the actors.
Right.
Because you can't name the top five highest producing writers. You can't name the ones that have gotten the most screenplays produced. You know a few of them. Like Gary Whatta is, you know, the one who did Rogue One. He's very active on Twitter. But like, there are a few writers that are very active on Twitter, but they're not household names. Right. Matt Damon is a household name. Like, you know, it's Fred Drescher is a household name. Like, it's gonna be harder to paint those folks in a negative light. Your best opportunity is to say they're all a bunch of greedy selfish people squabbling over, you know, a large sum of money that would, you know, that is determinative. The truth of the matter is most actors make less than $50,000 a year, some cases less than $30,000 a year.
Yep. The minimum to get health insurance is $26,000, and most actors don't make that.
80% of the SAG members don't qualify under that number. It's astonishing. It's crazy. Those are Medicaid numbers. Like, the poverty line is $18,000 a year.
Yep.
Like, I get it. You're subsidizing that with hostessing jobs and serving jobs and bartending jobs to keep yourself going. And a lot of those, you know, Fran Drescher addressed the industries that serve the entertainment industry in the city of Los Angeles, how they're going to be impacted. I mean, it's the AI stuff is really a slippery legal slope. And I'm hopeful that the actors, along with the writers in combination, can really push this out there, get people educated on it, and really force the leaderships back on it. Because, man, it you know, they're talking on everybody I've seen in regards to a timeline, industry insiders, anything I've seen says October at the earliest. And if it goes into the holiday season, like, good luck getting anything out until 2025, like, of like major movies, like the way we're with the stuff we cover on a weekly basis.
Yep.
Good luck getting any of that stuff till 2025.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember all the reports, but I know Captain America finished right before the deadline. And even with that, they had to push out back that release from May to the middle of the summer, I believe. Deadpool is shooting right now. They had to stop. Beetlejuice was almost done. They had to stop. Those are the ones I remember off the top of my head. And all those things.
Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 2 has been delayed. Right. Stranger Things Season 5 is, good luck getting that until 2025, because they were supposed to start in June, and they stopped in May with the writer's strike, so they never even got to set.
Yeah, and all that stuff, most of that stuff, is supposed to start hitting next year. So now you're pushing all that back until at the earliest, late next summer, if you're lucky. But more than likely, you're looking at third quarter next year. So it's costing the studios real money. Now, the thing is, they won't feel it until next year. So that's their bargaining chip. They can wait out individuals longer. That's the whole point of a union. The union, you stay together, and in staying together, you have that strength to be a bargaining chip. But the AI thing is really disturbing, and I really hope they can get where they want to go on that. And on the flip side, I hope I hope that they can work through the residual issues, because that's been a really big sticking point.
Yeah, the tax loophole itself is a thing Congress would have to fix, but they've very specifically been talking about getting in writing in the new contract ways to deal with the shelved properties as a result of the tax loophole, so that these people aren't missing out on this revenue that would be, you know, Ezra Miller, for whatever he's worth, is going to keep getting checks off the Flash. Like, Batgirl's not.
Right.
You know, so... the other major point that I've seen brought up today is performance clauses. It was pointed out that Iger has incentive bonuses in his contract that say for every certain amount of profit the company makes, he receives X amount of bonus. That's how his salary plus bonuses could exceed five times the $25 million amount that's listed in the contract. And yet, according to sources, when SAG or the Writers Guild bring up performance enhancing bonuses for their work, they're laughed out of the room by the executives. So, like, that's also seems to me to be problematic. I mean, we deal with this in sports all the time. There's you know, $125,000 for making a Pro Bowl, you know, $200,000 for making an All-Pro team, you know, $5,000 for catching X number of passes. You know, we deal with that kind of stuff all the time. I don't see why it would be an issue to put those into writer and actor contracts, except to, you know, save more money.
It's all about, like, these CEOs are not there to make entertainment, to make art, whatever you want to call it. They are there to maximize profits for the company, for the shareholders.
That's what we say about Greg Sankey and Roger Goodell all the time. Say what you want to, whether you like them or not. Sankey just got his extension too. Like, they work for the owners, or in Sankey's case, he works for the school presidents. School presidents are making more money than they ever have in the Southeastern Conference. They're going to keep that guy in charge. They're going to keep that guy working for him because he's making them money. And guys like Iger, you know, he's turning around the ship after Chadwick has been gone. He's trying to turn the big battleship around, and we'll see if he can or not. But, like, right now, the only thing they care about is if you keep making them money, they'll be good.
That's it. But part of making money is not just making the entertainment that generates money. Part of it is the whole, part of it is downsizing your employees. It's the tax write-off for pulling properties off. It's, they're there to squeeze every nickel out of every nook and cranny instead of, when we think of it, we think they're making a product for people to consume. And that is what's generating the money. Yes, but to maximize profits, that's when all these other things come in that just abuse their workforce in every which way. And I want to circle back to the residuals real quick, particularly for the TV side. Like for actors, for most working actors, TV residuals is what they live on, because most of them don't make millions of dollars, but they get on an episode of network TV, they get the money from that in perpetuity as long as that is running. And with the advent of all these streaming services and the decline of TV, they have to restructure how residuals are paid out for streaming, because a show sitting on Netflix is not the same as it running on like TBS. You're going to get the money from TBS. For streaming, it's negotiated, it was minuscule. They need to redo that. The studios don't want to redo that. And in doing that, the part about them pulling these shows off, because that just, they pull them off and then they don't ever air them again. Those people don't ever see any residuals. That's another way of them cutting these corners to save a nickel here, to further 0.00001 up the shareholder price. It's just like, it's all disheartening to me. Because it's all like, this is what capitalism is, run amok. I'm not a money person like that. I don't like it. I think running companies this way is not sustainable. And we see that. Look at WB, because that's all this is. It's a company trying to maximize profit. So they bought WB, got what they could for it, sold it to somebody else. And that sale maximized their profits. That scrapped down WB got picked up by somebody else. They scraped it down some more and they sell it off and get a big chunk of change for it, maximizing their profits. It doesn't enhance what WB does. It just keeps stripping it down till it's just bare bones. And I mean, it's going to always be worth something, but not what it could be if we didn't have such a, if the system wasn't designed to just strip away things all in the name of making quote unquote the most money.
Well, and that's always been my problem, is that we go back to trickle down. And trickle down as an economic theory is dependent upon CEOs and corporations being good, like inherently being good and considerate of others. Trickle down takes into account the idea that if you give a corporation a tax break on their revenues or their businesses, that the owner of said business will take the money that he's saving by not having to pay the federal government, and he will use it for capital improvements for his restaurant or his workshop or flower shop or bakery or whatever. He'll take the tax break money and buy new ovens or buy new equipment for the store. Or he'll take that money and he'll, you know, pay for employee health insurance. Or he'll take that money and he'll, you know, give it as bonuses to people at the end of the year. And then those people receive those bonuses, and then they'll take that bonus money and then they'll go spend it in the local economy, which will drive businesses even more that are surrounding it, because they have to pay bills with it. Go buy groceries, yada, yada. And that's the whole idea of trickle down. The trickle down is dependent upon the idea that these corporations are good-hearted enough to actually consider, you know, taking the money that they make that by not paying the federal government and spending it on others, instead of just, you know, oh, look, extra money. Cayman Islands, hi. Like, and or, hey, CEO budget, CEO pay. Yes, you've made us more money. Here's more money for you. Like, that's what it doesn't take into account. It doesn't take into account the idea of, you know, ultimate greed.
Right, right. Like, all these systems work fine if, you know, people are altruistic and greed is not the motivating factor. But
if it's not necessarily altruistic, but if it's just fair, if it's just everybody's on a level playing field, you know, operating under the same motives, when you go through college, you get driven into your head that like communism was never designed to be an equal economic system. It was just designed as a utopian theory, right? And like, that's the thing, is like, trickle down is dependent upon a utopian society where in which Fortune 500 CEOs are not worried about themselves or their profitability, but they're worried about their workers and keeping their workers happy. And that just doesn't exist.
Nope, does not.
And like, all of these, like you said, all of these systems are basically built around fundamental fairness and equality. And that doesn't happen, and that doesn't actually work. And in this case, what I'm concerned about, and this is something I wanted us to talk about on the podcast, was like, there are industries outside of just the right, like the writers and the actors who are now out of work. Right. You're talking about something. If you want to take just a basic example, the caterers who do craft services for these big massive productions that shoot in LA and other places around the country and around the world, those people don't have jobs anymore. Talking about the VFX artists, we talk all the time about how harshly the VFX artists are treated and how poorly they are, their working conditions are, and how much they are underpaid. They too don't have work right now because there aren't new shots coming in for them to render and fix and do all the things. Something even as basic and as simple as a boom mic operator or a key grip. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't have work right now. And the fact is, like, rent is rent, and it's due on the first, whether you have it or not, unfortunately. And it's harder for a boom mic operator or a key grip or a craft services employee to stick this out for as long as a movie star is going to be able to. But in the end, I think that all of those folks will benefit too. It's just, I don't want them to get lost in them in that struggle that they're going to have to go through and fight for the good fight to be fought, to get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier. Like you said, these are very much the people that aren't talked about. I believe they have their own union, but it doesn't matter if they have their own union right now. They're at the mercy of there being productions, and there are no productions going on right now. There cannot be until this is resolved. And my biggest thing with them is, like, I know that they know the game doesn't stop it from hurting as much, but I want people, when they're brought up, and they're going to be brought up, and they're going to be brought up by, I'm almost positive, by one side and only one side in this, like, to say that, you know, somebody's going to point a finger at them and say, these people are hurting because these other greedy people won't come back to work. So when the CEOs, when the companies do that, I just hope people understand that the companies don't care about them either. I'm sure those people are not getting their fair share either. And like you said, hopefully once this is over, it will help. It will be a rising tide that will help everyone. I just don't want them to feel, be used as pawns to get people, to get public sentiment to feel one way about them. When the people that are going to be using that are not the people that would have their best interests at heart.
Iger bringing up writing assistants today. And like Disney has some of the lowest paid writers assistants in the industry. And yet he's sitting there talking about, you know, how it's unjust for writers assistants to be asking for what they're asking for. It's like, dude, come on now.
Yeah, it's the actual number when it comes to money that they want is less than one of these CEOs makes. It's not Iger. It might be the Netflix dude. But it's, I don't understand how anybody can see what's going on and not be on the side of the worker. And who can possibly be on the side of these corporations that are just out here trying to keep their bucks to themselves?
Well, let's also just reiterate not every actor in LA or in New York or anywhere in the world that's under the SAG banner, not every SAG member has 3 houses, 6 dogs, 4 cars, and a pool house. Like, there are actors who are living job to job, just like you and I are.
Yep,
Paycheck to paycheck. Hours matter, and hours on the job matter. And yeah, they're better paying jobs than what some of us have in some of our local communities, but that doesn't mean that the cost of living doesn't adversely affect what they make and make it harder to live. And so I don't want this to get distorted. Like, every actor that's fighting for better rights, for better pay, for a more equitable share is like living the Tom Cruise life. Like, we're dealing with some like legitimate, like, day-to-day actors who are, you know, just as struggling as the person in, you know, Saginaw, Michigan, or, you know, Portsmouth, Maine. So
it's I'm really frustrated, I guess, for this whole thing. It's just I just don't like the whole taking advantage of workers just for the greed of a corporation. Not even the greed of the people running the place, the greed of the corporation. It just doesn't sit right with me.
Well, again, this has just been this time period that we're living in is the culmination of deregulation and, you know, corporatism that has been allowed to grow over the course of the last 40 years and is the result of actions by both political parties. You know, it's this is what happens when you get close to corporate personhood, you know, and that's just like, this is the result of years and years and years of deregulation and change in capitalistic methods and economics. And it's just, they're putting a huge spotlight on it. And I'm glad that they are. But what they're doing, like the way that the CEOs and the entertainment companies are acting is not that much different from your local business owner who doesn't want to pay, you know, servers minimum wage and would like to continue to only have to pay them $2.13 an hour plus tips.
It's not, they got away with that for a long time. It's not going to work like that anymore.
Well, the pandemic changes things. Like, people fundamentally during the pandemic realized they weren't making a living wage and will now, especially in collective bargaining situations, collectively bargain to make sure that they can have a living wage.
Yep. And that's the way it should be. And I'm hoping, that is my hope for this whole thing, is that that coming out of this, it helps not only this industry, but all of them have workers have better wages, are treated like people. Just treat people like people. You know that you're squeezing everything out of these workers, that they can't live, they can't pay their own things doing your job. just be fair with people, man.
Indeed. So, Chad, the only thing that could save us in these perilous and disastrous times is the Barbieheimer. The Barbieheimer is upon us. Your thoughts, sir, on Nolan and his film, Gerwig and her film, the way that everybody has been cross-promoting each other, and the fact that they are going to be the last two big Hollywood premieres that actually had, you know, regular premieres.
I'm glad that, the Oppenheimer crew, they were like, if the call for the strike comes down, we're walking out like right now. Like, we'll walk out in the middle. And I think they did press for it. Was it last night or the night before? The night before the strike was called, they did press for it. And then when they knew the call was coming down, they're like, okay, we're out. And whatever they had the next day, Nolan came out and said, well, it's just me. Because, you know, directors give, what up? We did our thing, but they're gone. And I'm glad that happened on that biggest stage for people to see the big star saying, we're standing in solidarity with our union. We're not going to even be there. All of them. Yeah,
you had the anonymous quote to Deadspin about, you know, the fall festival season being screwed because, you know, no movie stars are going to be at these festivals to promote these big, huge films in the fall.
Yeah, that was that's the big thing. Like, well, I don't know what big movies we have coming out after this, but seeing them have to promote these movies with no actors, they're already limited in what they can do because the shows they normally go on aren't running. So it's going to be very visible real soon that this is going on. So I appreciate that for Oppenheimer. Now to the Barbieheimer of it all. I think when it's all said and done, Nolan should go back on the Warner lot and give whoever put Barbie on that weekend, he should just buy them a little gift because I thought Oppenheimer would do well, but I think at least opening weekend, it's going to do better than it would have normally because people are making such a big deal out of both of them coming out at the same time that it will drive people to see both of them on the same day or at least both in the same weekend, which will drive up Oppenheimer's numbers. I fully believe Barbie's going to win the weekend, but I think the Oppenheimer numbers are going to be goosed by the fact that people are really driving home this double feature idea for Barbie and Oppenheimer. So I'm really excited to see how that weekend plays out. Outside of that, I'm really curious about Barbie. I've been on record saying I've been curious since this thing was announced and put together. Oppenheimer, I think is going to be a really good movie, really well put together, really well acted. And I'm going to be sitting there with my personal bias against Christopher Nolan, who I think is kind of a pretentious douchebag sometimes, and it enough for me to call him that and to like really actively think about it when I see his movies from now on. So that's where I'm at on him.
Put something in perspective, Chad. Warner Brothers is going to take a bigger loss on The Flash than they did on Tenet. And Tenet was the very first movie re-released in theaters 4 months after the start of the pandemic. Like, that's crazy. So here's my thing. I'm going to be one of the ones doing the double feature. There's like 25,000 of us that have already committed through Stubbs to do it. I'm doing the Oppenheimer first and then lifting myself back up with Barbie because otherwise I need a sip bourbon afterward. I've also been spending, like, because of my inconsistent work schedule right now, like, I've had a lot of time. Jim put out a tweet thread about some Oppenheimer Project Manhattan Project related films and TV shows that he wanted to watch in preparation before Oppenheimer came out. And so I've done some digging into some of those as well, which has helped kind of give me a different perspective because all of them follow different people and different aspects of the story of the Manhattan Project. So I've really enjoyed following up on that thread of gems. Look, I mean, Oppenheimer is Oppenheimer. That movie is a $20 to $25 million opening weekend almost any time you put it out there. It wouldn't be one of his biggest openers. It wouldn't be one of his smallest openers. Barbie's going to win the weekend just based on the fact that tracking's already over 100 million. The theater count is going to be over, like, there's a theater count of plus 900, I think, or plus 700 for Barbie. Barbie's in the 4,000s, Oppenheimer's in the 3,000s. And I think part of that is the large premium large formats. Poor Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is going to get shoved off the PLEs for, like, it's only going to have it for, like, 8 days because it opened on a Tuesday. It's only going to have it for, like, 8 days before it gets shuffled off for Barbie and Oppenheimer. But, like, Barbie's going to win the weekend. Oppenheimer's going to come in second. Oppenheimer's going to be in the conversation when we get to next March, which, you know, let's hope that all this has been resolved by then. If not, we're going to have an even crazier Oscar season than we normally have, because we're going to have a whole bunch of films, some of which no one's ever heard of before, that are going to be in the running, and then people are going to be going, who are these nominees? I mean, they do that already, but especially with no promotion, I mean, like, it would be weird. But yeah, Oppenheimer's going to be in the conversation, and, you know, Barbie's going to be in the conversation from everything I've heard about costume design and production design and sets and those kind of things. So, I think it'll be a good weekend for cinema, and it's a good last hurrah weekend because it's perfectly placed at what is now the end of the summer. There was a point in time where you could put something on Labor Day weekend, and that was the end of the summer. End of the summer is now, like, July, this last two weekends of July, or the last weekend of July, because people start going back to school August 8th. So, you know, it's crazy as that sounds, it's a good way to end the summer with these two mega blockbuster films. Now, Nolan did come out and officially say it cost more than $100 million, which I was glad of him to come out and confirm that number, because otherwise what you would have gotten would be a bunch of think pieces on how Nolan's movie is actually profitable and Indiana Jones wasn't. Like, I was happy to see Nolan come out and say, yeah, $100 million is, like, a very baseline, basic figure. In reality, it was closer to this number. When you add, and that is before you add in marketing. So his production is always going to be naturally more expensive, just given the fact that, like, he shoots on film. And doesn't just shoot on film, he shoots on IMAX film. So just inherent in that is going to cost more. You know, when you got a damn print of the movie that's 600 pounds, I mean, come on now.
Yeah, I did see the reel.
It's just like, he shoots on film. His budgets have gone up. You know, he's not going back to making something like The Prestige or Insomnia. Okay, his budgets are going to be way bigger now than they were pre-Batman. It's just like, that's the way it is. He's going to get great performances. He chooses his own material, just like Tarantino. He's very careful with what projects he goes in on. And if it's not Warner's, anybody and everybody in Hollywood would love to have that guy working for them. So, like, whenever he has another project to shop around, it'll be just as hot of a commodity. Same way, I don't know if Tarantino has started shopping around his ninth film about a film critic set in the 1970s, but, I mean, that's an easy yes for any executive in Hollywood. So we'll see. But, like, I'm happy the Barbie Oppenheimer thing is happening because it brings attention back to movie theaters and puts butts in seats, which right now is the most important thing.
It is. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to that.
Especially when you have an astroturfing by conservatives of a certain film that is rocketing up the box office chart, but not putting those butts in seats.
Yeah, when all is said and done on that movie, it's going to be interesting to really get what a lot of people are feeling will be the truth about that movie, and that it's selling a lot of tickets, but are people actually seeing the movie? And how are they counting these tickets? Because it's, from what I understand, the little donation ticket stuff, they don't have to use that money for the movie. And they're charging a flat rate, which, you know, it might be more than what it would have been had whoever went to see it somewhere else. I suppose we should say that it's the It's the Jim Caviezel movie. I forget the name of it.
Let Freedom Ring or something like that.
Something like that. It's the story of Tim Ballard, a guy popular in right-wing circles for leaving the CIA to go like vigilante hunt down child traffickers. And because of who Jim Caviezel is now, he is a QAnon conspiracy theorist that he believes the works of QAnon, and Ballard is big in that movement. That people have questions about this movie,
and he's hoping that this will get him enough notoriety to get The Passion 2 made. So
I mean, God bless him. I don't know who wants to see that, and I don't really know what story you tell when you tell you tell the story of how he died, and now we're supposed to what?
Well, if you want to get into that, the Bible has a line, a specific outline of the 40 days, broadly generalized of people and places that Christ appeared, but it doesn't drill down on specifics about what he did in the 40 days between the resurrection and the ascension. So if you wanted to take creative biblical liability, which is doesn't seem like this guy has got any problem with doing that kind of a thing, you could potentially just make a movie about Christ walking around, a resurrected Christ walking around Jerusalem, preaching and teaching and performing miracles and, you know, spending time with the apostles and whatnot. Like, you know, that could very easily be your passion too.
I think a lot of the allure of the first passion, outside of people that wanted to see Jesus movie, was the fact that it was
torture porn.
Yeah,
it was torture porn, and there would be no torture in a passion too that follows after the resurrection. Like, you know, exactly. So
and I really believe when people heard about how gruesome the violence was in the Jesus movie, they had to go see it. I've still yet to see it. I'm never going to watch that movie.
What a time to be alive, 2004, when like that was the thing everybody had to go see. And church groups buying up tickets and renting out whole theaters and the whole nine yards. Made over $700 million, Chad, in 2004.
I remember being gobsmacked at how much money this thing made. I'm like, but then, you know, I was talking to my parents, and I know that their church back home, they were talking about, for context on this, when I left for college, after I left for college, there are only two movies I can remember my mom talking about going to see with a group of people. The Passion is one, the other is Black Panther. That's it.
Yeah, it's what a weird, weird time. So we have news of casting for Superman Legacy, and we have internet reaction to castings in Superman Legacy. Your thoughts, sir, on the, oh my God, James Gunn is turning a Superman movie into the Suicide Squad Part 2.
Okay. I've been kind of stewing on this for a little bit, so I'm not going to actually talk about the individual casting of the individual people. I will still do that. I'll probably do that tomorrow. So you'll probably hear it after you hear this. But the reaction from people have been, I get it from most people that he's including all these characters from DC Comics that are not from Superman's world per se, but they're like Justice League adjacent. And people are A, worried that it's too many characters, and B, worried that the focus won't be on Superman, and that they're only there to build out the universe. Okay, so first, I understand your concerns about a lot of characters, but what I would like for any of y'all to do, I want you to pick out your favorite movie that's not a comic book movie, not a genre film at all, nothing like that. I want y'all to pick it out. I want y'all to actually go ahead and watch your movie and stay and watch the credits. And when the credits come up and it says cast, I want you to sit there and start counting the people that are in the actual cast, of name people that are in the cast of your favorite movie. And know that the first, you know, six of them are your main cast, and then the rest are like principal actors and very limited supporting people that have a name that they decide to put up there. That list for most movies is, you're probably going, I'm going to be generous and say, you're going 15 people deep. I think it's going to be more than that, but more than likely 15 people deep. So just by the nature of movies, casts are larger than you think. So when you see announcements of more people being added to the Superman movie, and you start freaking out that it's too many characters, all movies have too many characters by their definition. I need you to calm down. I need you to calm down. To those that are saying that, why is he using, like, it, that they're only there to expand the universe, I want you to recognize that James Gunn himself has said that that's not what he does. He's even said this since the casting announcement has happened. He's like, they're in this movie to fit, because they fit the story I'm telling. They are there to help. They're there for the story. Story is first. I'm using them to tell this Superman story. So one, you just have to, you know, you have to trust him. You have to believe him and what he's saying. Two, we don't, again, we don't know the context of them using them, but I mean, in a regular movie, you can have the main character interact with a smart person that, to get information from, a, let's say, a cop to help them with an investigation or some crap like that. And, you know, just another person that's familiar with the thing. You can have those just be regular people. In a Superman movie, you can have those same roles just be regular people. However, you're in a Superman movie with all DC access. So instead of making it a random cop that Superman talks to, he could be talking to Mr. Terrific that has the same information. Or scientists, he can talk to Mr. Terrific. The random cop, he can be talking to Metamorpho. They serve those same roles that would normally be there anyway if it was just a regular Superman movie. It's just with those DC characters. That is speculation on my part, yes, but it's not hard to see how you use those characters and not interfere with your solo Superman movie. And my final thing on this, and I think I can wrap it up after this, to those people that I've seen for years say, you know, they bang on Marvel because Marvel is producer-driven, is not director-driven, they don't have an auteur, that you don't know, you can see, look at these movies, tell the director has no vision, they're only executing what Marvel has put in front of them. You would rather have a bad director-driven movie than have whatever you think the studio stuff is that Marvel puts up. I've seen those same people complain about these casting decisions when we know for a fact that this is James Gunn's movie. He is, in this instance, he is an auteur. Being co-head of DC, he's not mandating himself to put characters in there just to put them for character's sake. No. He's putting them in there because he wants them in there for the story, because he is the auteur and this is his vision. So you can't, on one hand, complain that you don't like, that you hate that there are no auteur-driven movies, and then on the other hand, complain about what this auteur, what you want, is doing in his movie because you think it's building to a large universe. Well, newsflash, he wants to build a large universe. It is his vision to do it in this movie. You can't knock that. You cannot like it, but you can't knock it, and you can't complain about it, because that is what you've been saying you wanted. You wanted an auteur. Well, he's an auteur. He's not an auteur in the way that you used to. You're thinking of, oh, Christopher Nolan, I only want this one thing. Or Matt Reeves, I only want this one thing. No, this auteur says, I like all of them. I want them all to play together. And that is my vision that I'm putting in this movie. So if you're one of those people, like the auteur-driven stuff, but you're bitching and moaning about these casting decisions, I want you to look at that and maybe evaluate what you really, really don't like, which is you just don't like having all these characters together. It has nothing to do with auteur-driven anything, because you're really hypocritical right now, and I just want you to recognize that. And I think I did that without being too pissed off.
Indeed. So, Chad, tell me, how much screen time across the original Guardians movie does the Collector have?
The Collector? I mean, he's technically only in the first. He shows back up in...
No, I'm just talking about just the first, just in the first movie.
Just the first movie? He's just on the screen.
First movie is like 8 to 10 minutes. Yeah, 7 to 8 minutes, and most of that is exposition.
Yep.
How much screen time does Cosmo the space dog have in Guardians 3?
Cosmo is on screen. He's probably a little longer, so probably about 10 to 12 minutes.
And how much screen time does the Sean Gunn character get in the original Guardians movie?
Oh, Kraglin's in the movie no more than like 15 minutes.
And yet all of those players play a pivotal role in the plot mechanics of those Guardians movies, correct?
Correct.
But none of them are on screen taking time away from Peter Quill and Drax and Mantis and Groot and the whole gang, right?
Correct.
It's still their story, right?
It is very much their story.
It is not the collector's story, right?
Nope.
Not Cosmo the Space Dog's story. Although I would like to see a Cosmo the Space Dog meets Howard the Duck movie. It's not Cosmo the Space Dog's movie, is it?
No.
It's a Guardians of the Galaxy movie. And that's the story. Like, that's the whole point. Sure, these other folks can be in the movie. Hell, we just had a Marvel movie last May that had the freaking Illuminati in it. Like, it wasn't the Illuminati's movie. It wasn't Reed Richards played by what's-his-name's movie. It wasn't Haley... It wasn't Haley Carter's Captain Britain, which he hated, apparently. Nope, it's Doctor Strange's movie. So just because characters and actors are in these movies doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to take up large amounts of screen time and take attention and spotlight away from the main person or the main protagonist of the film.
And to that point, you made me think of the other point. They're also forgetting that this is the guy that managed all the characters through all those Guardians movies. He also did a DC movie where he had a large cast, and he managed all of them. Not only did he manage them all, he cast a whole bunch of people to be in the movie for all of about 4 minutes to die. And nobody knew it until we walked in. James Gunn knows how to, if nothing else, James Gunn has a vision that he knows his vision, and he goes to execute it. You can like it or not. And he knows how to handle a lot of characters, particularly like the Suicide Squad is really like his magnum opus of handling characters, because there's really like 20 characters in there. Yes, he kills 10 of them at the very beginning, but still, you don't know that until they die. So he knows how to manage them and tell his story. And we're not getting that many characters in the Superman movie. And this Superman movie will be a Lois and Clark Superman movie, like he said. And that's what I want. I don't know about the rest of y'all, but
I'm just super excited that the hyena man made it through, resuscitated, and ran off.
Oh, Weasel.
That, Weasel just made me happy. Like that just made me happy. Even though he's gonna go off and eat children, it's fine.
But,
so I mean, that was just my first thought. Is that like, you know, these are supporting characters. These aren't even big household DC names. I mean, considering that in the sequel to Man of Steel, Batman and Wonder Woman show up. I mean, I think we can deal with this.
But those people they'll point to Batman versus Superman and Doctor Strange for that matter and be like, that's what we're going to get. They're only going to throw these characters in just to throw them in, and not, they don't serve a story. They're just to build up the universe. And I don't think that's what we're getting.
It doesn't seem like that's his thing. He very much has a role and a purpose like I said, Cosmo the Space Dog serves a purpose. Like the collector serves a purpose, you know, Star-Lord's Earth grandfather, you know, serves a purpose. Like, they may not be in it. Adam Warlock serves a purpose. He starts the whole action, all the action for volume three. Like, he's not in it very much, but he starts the action. I mean, there's a purpose for him being there. I mean, he doesn't, Gunn doesn't seem to be a writer who is like just gonna do things for the sake of doing things.
No. And he, you know, in talking about the differences between the companies, he's like, the only thing Marvel ever made him do was
put Thanos
in Guardians 1. And even with that, like he might not have had Thanos in the original draft, but Thanos fits with the characters he chose and the direction that they, it was a thing where the characters he chose and the direction that they were going, it fit. So I don't think it was as big an ask as you would think, because I think he probably would have pushed back if it was somebody that didn't fit. But Thanos fits the story.
And it fits the comic book history of the characters that he chose. And he got the chance to redesign Thanos in the way he wanted to. And he was the first director to work with Brolin. Right. Because remember, they had just had a stunt coordinator guy do the CG for the post credits on Avengers. So he got to really be the first one to fully form Thanos in the MCU before the Russos. So that was a marriage of material and character that worked for everybody. But I think that if they just said, hey, you have to put Mr. Fantastic in Guardians 3, you know, he would have like flown Kevin the finger.
Yeah. Cause he didn't, since the Thor stuff happened after he left, I think that's how that went. He didn't really know how he was going to get rid of Thor. But Thor was never going to be in the movie. He would have probably just had like a throwaway line just for himself if Love and Thunder didn't happen. But, you know, he does, he doesn't just put people there just to put them there.
Indeed. That'll about do it for this week's episode of the Movies on the Brain podcast. You can keep up with this podcast by following us on Twitter. I am at @BCWTigerFan.
At the Mets Theory.
Thank you very much, and look for Mark Sanchez on the picket lines.
Oh, boy.